I'm going to shake this up, I can tell you. There's a big cultural change on the way.
Put down your binoculars, ladies and gentlemen. Malcolm has arrived.
I have two words for you. I'm back.
Together, we will make America great again.
The Wrap. The Wrap.
It's the end of the week. Time to wrap up some of the biggest stories of the past few days. And look, you know, no prizes for guessing what they are. The Herald Sun's national political editor, Annika Smethurst, is one of my guests. Nicholas Rees, who's a principal fellow from Melbourne University, is my other. Hi, guys.
G'day.
G'day, Patricia.
Let's begin with the Barnaby elephant, Barnaby New Zealand kiwi fruit elephant in the room. Woo! Deputy Prime Minister. He finds out he's a dual citizen, a Kiwi, thanks to his dad. I'm just going to start with how he broke it to us all.
Last Thursday afternoon, the New Zealand High Commission contacted me to advise that, on the basis of preliminary advice from their Department of Internal Affairs, which had received inquiries from the New Zealand Labor Party, they considered that I may be a citizen by descent of New Zealand. Needless to say, I was shocked to receive this information.
Needless to say, Annika, he was shocked, as Darren Chester, one of his colleagues, said to me this week. There is no one more Australian than Barnaby Joyce, which I think in terms of stereotypes might be true.
Yeah, you'd think that in terms of the hat and the, you know, Blundstones and his accent. But, yeah, it turns out that doesn't necessarily mean you are Australian, as we've learnt this week. And many of the Nationals are learning too. It does seem to be they're the party. It started off with the Greens, but I think the Nationals have taken the cake this week. The Internationals, people are now calling them. So, look, it does seem particularly unfair in many cases. I'm not saying that Larissa Waters was, you know, her case was very unfair too. She was 3 months old when she left, and the law changed shortly after she was left. But she was born there, and she always knew she was born there. In a case like Barnaby, or now with Fiona Nash, she had very little to do with her father, who was the connection there. He was Scottish. He left and wasn't on the scene much after she was about 8 years old. So it does prove that, yes, you need to check these things, but if we're going back to grandparent stages, it's quite a complicated sort of formula, and some countries make it very difficult to give up some of these citizenships too.
They certainly do, and they also make it quite confused. I found that in the case of New Zealand about, you know, I mean, the Australians reporting right now that there was the first time they inquired about this, that actually they were given the advice back that you have to apply. So there is actually a bit of confusion around some of this, Nicholas.
Yes, I agree. And look, I've got to say, I think the law's an ass on this one. If you look at the history of the drafting of Section 44 of the Constitution, it was borrowed from a UK Act, and it was given a twist in the Australian case to make it particularly onerous. And, you know, now here we are 117 years later, and we're starting to see what the ramifications are of that, where you do get what I think are absurd situations where Nick Xenophon, because of a connection to Cyprus, being a British colony, could potentially, because of British deeming provisions before a particular year, could find himself having dual citizenship. Now, who could possibly have guessed that? So, look, I think it is a very, very problematic section in the Constitution. The problem, of course, is that it's next to impossible to change because, you know, could you imagine how a referendum would go where we had to ask the Australian people whether it was okay for Australian parliamentarians to be dual citizens or have loyalty to potentially more than one country? It wouldn't have a snowflake's chance in hell of getting passed. And so the law is the law, and we've got Nick Xenophon, Barnaby Joyce and five others known to be in a whole lot of trouble and potentially more to go.
So let's get to some of the things that happened this week. And I know, Nicholas, you're in Canberra this week, so was I. Really dramatic week in Canberra. Like, really, I haven't seen one quite like this one. And what we also saw is the way that Labor hit back on this. The government, not to be clear, hit back on this. They hit back by saying that there was basically a conspiracy with a foreign power. And it was pretty extreme language. Did it fly?
Not at all. I think Julie Bishop may have over-egged this one, and many people sitting on her own side of the house think so too. Look, I guess they had nowhere to go when this had happened. It was an interesting strategy, but to turn it on Labor and to say that there's some sort of, you know, colluding with a foreign power, we know how politics works. They know how politics works. They dig dirt on the other side and vice versa. This wasn't any sort of, you know, collusion with a foreign power to undermine the government of the day. It was a case of, you know, one Liberal staffer ringing in contact in New Zealand and asking a question which had been asked by journos, as we said, you know, for weeks leading up to it. So was it responsible of the MP in New Zealand to ask that question and use their resources in Parliament to do it? Probably not. But at the same time, I think they really got the wrong angle and the wrong mood of the whole debate this week by trying to turn it on Labor in that way.
Well, Nicholas, you have been a former Labor staffer, a staffer to Julia Gillard. So tell me, would you have made that call?
Yes, I most certainly would have. And that's what was totally absurd about the, you know, claims of this week made by, well, firstly, what should be noted, it was made by Malcolm Turnbull on Tuesday, and then Julie Bishop as Foreign Minister went out there and backed him in. My analysis would be that she probably over-egged the case, but then they were still going with it on Wednesday in question time, and probably the most hilarious moment of the parliamentary week for me was, you know, in the, I think it was first or second, Dorothy Dixer in question time went to Julie Bishop. She got up and rolled out all the lines about this conspiracy between Labor and New Zealand to undermine the Commonwealth Government of Australia. And then just to make light of it, Tony Burke, the leader of the opposition in the House, got up and actually asked the same question again to Julie Bishop, just mocking her completely. So she had to repeat her Dorothy Dixer answer. But this time, of course, the question had come from Labor, just showing the government bench how ridiculous they thought the claims were.
That, yeah, when people are laughing about you, always a good sign that things are not going on track. Like, yeah.
And of course, if you're trying to, you know, dream up a conspiracy theory and aim it at the opposition, you want to make it slightly scary. You know, is anyone in Australia vaguely worried about Australians talking with New Zealanders? It's like saying, you know, a Labor staffer in Canberra rang a Labor staffer in Victoria or New South Wales to check with them the facts about a particular Victorian or New South Welshman's status. It was just totally ridiculous.
Apparently, I've just got a text. You allowed your guest to say that it was a Liberal person who rang New Zealand to check on Joyce without correction. That is disgraceful, PK. Did you just say that?
No, Annika did it. Okay. I think it was a slip.
It's called a misspeak. I don't think, yeah. But if, you know, you clearly were listening and knew that it was inaccurate, and it's called a misspeak. We know it was a Labor person. We know it. It's a fact. There's no one even disputing it. So in terms of where this all goes, Annika, I've realised I should just, like, keep my opinions to myself. Well, everyone's going to love quoting that. But no, honestly, because I keep going, oh, it's got to be over now. I thought it after Barnaby. It's got to be over now. You too, right? It's got to be over
yes.
now. And then Fiona Nash. And then I was like, after Fiona Nash last night, I was like, it's got to be over now. And then Nick Xenophon today. So I'm not saying anything else. Zip. There are going to be more, aren't there?
I've changed sides. Yeah, I thought it was definitely, there was only going to be two. I thought it was the Greens. I thought it was because their processes weren't, you know, strong enough. But already we're seeing other parties. Look, Labor are very confident that they don't have everybody. And I have spoken to them about the form, I guess, you fill out when you want to run for pre-selection. And it does seem, it's a bit different in every state, but it does seem maybe it asks a few more questions as opposed to the Liberal form. The Liberal form basically asks you to sign a stat deck and, you know, declare it yourself. Whereas the Labor form, in many states anyway, asks for your parents and your partner's sort of family history. That doesn't mean anything, though, in when it comes to some of the cases we've seen. Like when you're getting Barnaby Joyce getting a connection way back like that, surely there'll be others. Then there's probably a few MPs a bit stressed, and there's probably some that don't even know. I've spoken to every sort of MP I've run into this week. I've had a little chat about it, and they've all had a moment where they've been sitting at their desk or called their mum or dad and just, you know, just to check up on some of their ancestry that they weren't aware of. So I would not be surprised if we saw more of these.
Nicholas?
Well, I was a staffer in the office of Labor Prime Minister Julia Gillard, but also in a previous career, I was Labor Party Secretary. And I can tell you...
Oh, you were too.
The party does
go... the years roll on, Nicholas.
I know they do. It was many years ago. I had a lot less grey hair than I do now. But I can tell you that the Labor Party does go to great lengths to check on these things. Lawyers are engaged as part of the registration process, and they're usually very thorough. But even like today, I've got to tell you, with the Nick Xenophon case and just how precarious the link back to via Cyprus to the UK is, you know, even at that point, I was wondering, gee, did our lawyers really go that far and with that diligent with every single one of our candidates? So I think Labor has been much more thorough than the other parties generally on this. But wow, we're getting some pretty crazy cases come through now.
If you're just tuning in, go ahead.
I was about to say, to play the devil's advocate a little bit, for MPs that really have done their due diligence, I know there's been a lot of talk about Sam Dastyari, who apparently spent thousands to rid himself of Iranian citizenship. And I spoke to Michael Suka today, a Victorian MP whose dad is Lebanese and his mother is Norwegian. And he, off his own back, went and got all this checked by an immigration lawyer before he even put in an application to run. So there is a bit of frustration too, I think, from people who did do the work themselves, suggesting that maybe their colleagues perhaps could have done that when they did sign up.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive. We're wrapping up the Newsweek. You were just listening there to Annika Smethurst. She's the Herald Sun's national political editor for the Sunday papers, and Nicholas Rees, who's the principal fellow from Melbourne Uni. And I got a text here. Clearly people know exactly who you are, which is that I should disclose that you're also on the Melbourne City Council. Yes, you are.
Yes,
he's
I
also,
am.
I'll keep disclosing his stuff. He's a Sky News broadcaster. His show's on in about an hour. So, yeah, he has other hats too. So all disclosed. Is there anything else, citizenship, you need to disclose?
I'm a father. I was born in London. I believe I'm an Australian citizen, but who knows?
No, I don't believe you are at all now that you've told me that. All right, let's move to another big news story so we can give it some time. And that is a huge one, really, last weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, over the removal of Confederate statue. One woman was killed, 19 others injured, when a man allegedly drove his car into a crowd of people protesting against a white nationalist rally. First, there was an uproar because the US president took 2 days to condemn those who organised the white supremacists. And within a day of doing that, he appeared to double down on his previous comments, blaming both sides. This issue of blaming both sides has been very contentious, with even his own colleagues saying, you know, high-profile Republicans saying, you know, Nazis are not the same as anti-racism protesters. Here's a snippet from Donald Trump's fiery press conference earlier this week.
I've condemned neo-Nazis. I've condemned many different groups, but not all of those people were neo-Nazis, believe me. Not all of those people were white supremacists by any stretch.
Nick, wow. If you were Trump's advisor, what would you be telling him?
Gee, that's an impossibly difficult question. Look, I think he's got to go out now and again and again and again make it very clear that there's no such thing as a good Nazi. There's no such thing as a good Ku Klux Klansman. And that's the problem here, that he equivocated early in the week. He suggested that there was fault on both sides. And, you know, clearly there wasn't. It was an anti-racism rally and a bunch of white supremacists drove a car into the rally, killing one and injuring many. But he kind of made it look like it was an even-handed thing where there was potentially blame on both sides. I mean, this is really big this time because now he's got some of his most senior supporters in America walking away from him. So business leaders and many, many others. And I believe, in fact, his council of business advisors has collapsed now because so many of them have just simply refused to serve.
The ramifications of this one are just huge. Former KKK Grand Wizard David Duke praised Mr. Trump for not blaming just one side for the violence, which wasn't really helpful to Mr. Trump either when the white supremacist is actually saying thank you for your statement, right, Annika? I mean, that just absolutely played into people's analysis of what just happened.
Absolutely. And, you know, if perhaps Trump was trying to say that they weren't all, you know, signed up members of the KKK or signed up Nazis, however you do that, the point is that if you're on the same side as that mob, you're on the wrong side. And I don't think anybody is going to try and defend that. So it's incredible. And even watching him, some of his tweets after that about the Confederate statues, which really was sort of the kicker for this whole issue, he's really trying to play both sides in a lot of debates over there that's going on at the moment. He is not doing what we're used to Western leaders doing and coming out and condemning the bad, you know, really taking sides and deciding who is good and who is bad. It's an incredible thing to watch because we're just not used to this. I'm just interested in how it plays to his supporters. I don't think that, you know, there is an assumption we make about Trump supporters, but I don't think just because you voted for Trump, you're necessarily, you know, a member of the KKK. And I can't imagine that there'll be a lot of support from this. He will lose support on his own side.
Most policy debates have shades of grey in them. There are very few issues which are truly black or white, but this is black or white, okay? Yeah. Ku Klux Klan, ma'am, Nazis, to be sort of playing footsies with them or soft peddling in any way is just simply intolerable in a free country like the United States of America. And to your point, Annika, yeah, I think, you know, 99.99% of the people who voted for Trump are, of course, not racist. They're just probably Americans who wanted to make America great again, frankly.
Yeah, well, and they wanted sort of the thing, jobs
that's
back.
That's right, they wanted the jobs back, and he was the only guy really promising he was going to do that. And so this, I think, would turn off any everyday American. I'd be pretty confident about that.
Just one last thing on this, because we really want to move to our lighthearted stories, because we do want to have some moment of joy, right? But CEO of 21st Century Fox, James Murdoch, has weighed in. He's donated $1 million US to the Anti-Defamation League and written about the events of Charlottesville. In fact, really strong statement. What do you make of that, Nicholas?
I did see the email today. I mean, the James Murdoch, obviously being the CEO of the essentially the Murdoch media empire in the United States, has a pretty powerful voice in US politics. And it's a voice which he very rarely uses in terms of, you know, interfering with debates or making his views known. But to come out as he has, and he's come out in very, very strong terms, I really encourage people to have a look at this story and read the strength of the language he uses in condemning Trump for this. It's big, particularly when you remember how much US media the Murdochs do own.
They certainly do. Annika, let's go to move to the lighter stories, and not just to be clear with everyone, not because we don't think these other ones, we've given them a lot of time, but because I do think people have, it's Friday, people should have joy in their lives. What have you been reading about that might make us, you know, smile at least?
I must admit, I was walking around the office today thinking I hadn't read anything this week that wasn't about Trump
of course,
Hansen or citizenship. And I shouted out to the journalist I sat next to, who happens to work at the Weekly Times, and asked her what she had been writing about or reading. And she pointed out a story she did. This is Natalie Kotzios, that carp scales could be used to generate energy. And it's quite a good story. It's in the Weekly Times. You should all read it this week. I don't know where people like Barnaby Joyce will sit on ones like this. We know the dedication carp to coal we see, but we do know he also loves carp, and it will just no doubt give Labor more opportunity to yell that in question time. But yeah, it's quite an interesting story, and it basically says that carp scales could be used to generate electricity from dead carp. And, you know, we don't like carp, so there's a good use of them.
Oh, no, then maybe the windmills would be saved from scrutiny now. It'll be just all about the carp, right?
those ugly windmills, apparently.
Oh, I'm killing myself. All right, Nicholas Rees, Vladimir Putin is what you're going to raise with us. Thank you very much.
I bet you're wondering where I'm going to go with this
one.
So, you know, the thing I intrigued by and find so humorous about social media is what it can reveal about human nature. And one of the funniest hashtags that's popped up this week is Men Without Shirts. And it's a play on the fact that Vladimir Putin is a world leader who seems very fond of getting his shirt off, particularly when on holiday, riding bareback, going fishing, wrestling a bear. Who knows what he'll do next with his shirt off? And the CEO
of... That's because he's a very manly man.
He's a manly Russian man. And the CEO of Russia Telecom, the biggest telecommunications company in Russia, has gone and started this hashtag of Men Without Shirts, where guys can basically take photos of themselves on holiday with their shirts off. Strange, you may say, except on the first day it had 47,000 likes.
Really?
And now has become a global social media phenomena. And, you know, I suggest maybe after you've had a couple of glasses to relax this evening, have a look at that that hashtag is very strong.
You know, I didn't know about this. You have really brought genuine joy to my life because that's all I'm going to do tonight. Like, so I'm going to dinner with my partner. It's like, excuse me, I'm just looking at hashtags of shirtless Russian people.
Yep. They're not Chippendales, let me tell you. These are kind of middle-aged white guys kind of being daggy and perhaps behaving slightly badly.
That is very good. Hey, last thing we like to do on RN Drive before we, you know, move to the news and people get a bit more of a hit of all the awful things that are happening, and there's quite a few awful things after Barcelona as well. And that's recommendations, stuff to do on the weekend. Annika, what's your recommendation?
I went and saw a movie last week called The Trip to Spain, and it's a very good movie. Spain's going through a bit of an awful time at the moment, but if you want to see a beautiful side to that country and maybe to encourage people to get there, it is a comedy, but it's also a travelogue and it's hilarious. And if it's, I don't think it's at all cinemas, but if it's around, go and watch it.
Excellent. And Nick?
Look, if listeners are looking for us an interesting longer read, the latest edition of Mean Gin, the winter edition, has got a wonderful article in it by Catherine Murphy, the Canberra political reporter.
She's one of our regulars here, yep.
Yes, terrific journalist. And she's written a piece called The Political Life is No Life at All. And it actually talks about the quite horrid life that our politicians lead in that Canberra bubble and the 24-hour news cycle and everything comes with it, how perverse it is, and then what consequences that actually has for our political system, that the people who play in it have to live that sort of life. And there's a wonderful interview with Greg Combe, and he, you know, reflecting on his time in politics, and he comes up with what I think are some very sensible but quite radical suggestions for reform. So really good long form.
Can
read
you
that
just
one.
Tell us? We've got another minute, so we can. What are some of his suggestions for reform?
Well, he thinks that people shouldn't necessarily have to do 20 or 30 years in the Australian Parliament before serving as a minister of the Crown. That so in many jurisdictions around the world, you can actually serve as a member of the executive, like in the US system, by not having to be a member of the Congress, or in our case, the member of the Parliament. So he says, look, that's a way you could bring some expertise into the ministerial ranks without having to necessarily put that person through that crushing, frankly, life of spending all those years in the legislature. That's just one of his ideas.
That is really interesting. I will admit, you know, because I don't have to name any of them, but I do talk to a lot of politicians, as you would think I would. And I've got to say, a lot of them do struggle. Like, the thing I will reveal before we sign off is I get a lot, and I'm sure you know this, Annika, but of I call them the Sunday night blues before a sitting week. And I get the sense that leaving the family, that whole process is quite like, it's really difficult for them. Like, I'm not, you know, no one's going to be sympathetic, especially after this week, but you know what I mean. It is actually not easy.
I do. I have a lot of sympathy with the lifestyle of our politicians, you know.
Especially if you're a regional one. Yeah. Not only do they have to fly back to the capital city, they then have to often get in a car and drive for many hours. It's a long haul to do every few weeks and miss out on family time.
I was deeply honoured to work for in the Prime Minister's office, as anyone should be. And it was, you know, in some respects, the pinnacle of my professional career. But personally, it was totally crushing. And I don't mind admitting, I couldn't hack it in the end. It was just too much.
Yeah, it is difficult. Well, unless you move to Canberra like Annika did. And we can, journos, and I did for 8 years. Hey, guys, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Have a great weekend.
And joining me tonight were the political, the Herald Sun's national Sunday political editor, Annika Smethurst for the News Corp papers, and Nicholas Rees, who's a principal fellow from Melbourne Uni.